Members, we'll be starting with Senator Bach's bill, Senate File 977, which you'll find a little bit deeper into your packet. You know, we had to move that bill up. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Senate File 977 relates to the imposing of local sales taxes on manufactured or modular housing. Constituent issue that was brought to me over the course of the summer. There's an issue where you have a manufactured or a model home delivered to a community that has a local sales tax. Maybe delivered there, in the case of Hermantown in my district, they have a 0.5% local sales tax, and a manufactured or a modular home can be delivered there, dropped by the semi that's responsible for delivering it, picked up by another one, and then taken to its final destination, and it might only sit on the lot for a matter of hours. And there's a question about whether the local sales tax that's applicable to that city should apply to the sale of that home or not. And I would argue that it shouldn't, that the sales tax should be imposed at the place where the modular home is eventually located. And just because it happened to go through the yard where the manufactured or modular home dealer is, shouldn't subject them to the local sales tax. But I have with me a constituent that's found himself in this situation up in the city of Hermantown in my district, Dean Minardi, and he'd like to speak to why we're here today.
Morning.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record, please.
Dean Minardi with Easy Housing of Duluth. I'm a partner of a retail sales center where we sell manufactured and modular homes. As Senator Bach expressed our concerns, essentially we're being taxed. We tend to refer to it as a staging area where our homes will come from the manufacturer and then come to our sales center for temporary placement, if you will, and then our trucks will then take it to its final destination, which is very common and normal. The trouble that we have with the current bill is we're taxed once that home is disconnected from a truck that's transported to our sales center. And then we've experienced almost like a double tax, because then if the home goes to another city outside of Hermantown, of course, and that particular city has a local sales tax, then we are also charged that tax as well. I guess we would like to see it taxed at its final destination, which would be certainly fair and appropriate, versus taxing it in Hermantown when it's located outside the city of Hermantown.
Good question. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you pass these tax on to your customers? I have a couple questions. Your end users, do they, or do you actually have to do the bookkeeping and pay it yourself?
Mr. Minardi.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we pay the tax. We've held it to where we pay it. It's built into your costs. You're asking if
the
consumer pays it? Indirectly, yes.
Another question.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Bach, do you have the background on how this was created, this tax? How long, how old is it, and why?
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure somebody from Revenue is probably here, and I think they probably can better explain that than I can.
We have someone from the Department of Revenue who's willing to testify.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious how this all started.
Mr. Heck is joining us. Mr. Heck.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson. Could you repeat the question specifically?
Mr. Chair and Senator, Mr. Heck, how old, when was it imposed initially, and what was the intention behind it?
And Mr. Heck, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Greg Heck with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, basically the tax has been on modular manufactured homes since the beginning of the sales tax in '67. The thing that's possibly causing the problem here is in 2002, we imposed new sourcing rules where the sale would actually be taxed at. And under those sourcing rules, the law now provides that the tax is imposed at the point at which the person takes possession of the items. When the homes are delivered into Hermantown, the law would now say that they're subject to tax at that point in time when possession is taken by a contractor who is then going to take those items and install them at some other location. The contractor is treated as the final user consumer because they are not selling it in the form of tangible personal property. They're using it themselves in making a construction contract.
Mr. Chairman, then I guess my actual question is, their tax on the final sale, is there an actual 6.5 sales tax on a modular home?
Mr. Heck.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, there is not. The tax is embedded in the price of the home. As the witness had previously said, it's indirectly passed on to the customer in the sales price, but there is no sales tax on the final invoice.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
I think we should probably tax the end user, although a home is a home. It seems like it's a piece of property. Is there sales tax on a home that's got a foundation?
Mr. Heck.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, there is not sales tax on a home. There is not sales tax on any improvement to real property. If you have a window installed in your house by a contractor, by a carpenter, there wouldn't be any tax on it also. The tax only applies to sales of tangible personal property, something that's not attached to realty.
Thank you, Mr. Heck. So, I mean, what might be comparable is that there's tax that a construction company might pay on its materials. Perhaps this is similar, but we wouldn't charge it multiple times. It sounds like Senator Bach is going in the right direction here. Is there any other questions? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the witness, or Senator Bach. Isn't the issue here the local option sales tax? That's the issue, right?
Correct.
And if you tax where the home is being set up, then it would not be paying the local option sales tax, I believe.
The issue,
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, let me give you an example that lies within my district. If somebody from Two Harbors in my district purchases a home through Easy Housing, and the home comes from the manufacturer to their staging area in Hermantown, and the semi that has the contract to deliver it from the manufacturer unhooks it at Hermantown, Hermantown imposes a 0.5% local option sales tax on it. And then Mr. Minardi's truck, then the local hauler picks it up and hauls it to Two Harbors in my district, and where its final destination is, now they pay an additional 0.5% sales tax in Two Harbors because that's the final destination. That's the problem, is the tax should be imposed, the local sales tax should be imposed at the final destination of the manufactured home, not under current law, which it can be imposed twice.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Senator Bach or the witness? Seeing none, if there's no objection, we'll lay Senate File 977 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is Senator Jungbauer here?
It's a shitty deal.
He's not here. Want to go to Senator Dahl? Senator Dahl. Senate File 999. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning. This is a bill relating to act of tax increment financing for the city of Burnsville. The city of Burnsville has bought the southern half of the District 40, my district, also my home for over 20 years. The northwest quadrant of the city has been targeted for redevelopment. It's been a heavy industrial part of the city for over 50 years, and the city is looking at the next 50 years and trying to attract new types of business into that area. And this is a tool that they feel strongly that they need in their toolbox. Today I have the mayor of Burnsville, Mayor Kotz, with me to testify, city manager Craig Ebling, and deputy city manager Tammy Omdahl. Also, due to some of the conditions of the soil in the area, we do have, if there are questions, official from the PCA today. With that, I'll turn it over to Mayor Kotz.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you today about our project.
Your name for the record, please.
I'm sorry. Elizabeth Kautz, Mayor of Burnsville.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you about our vision to transition this 1,700-acre site that is a heavy industry. Just as we have added value to the region and to the state by landfilling garbage for the region and supplying our state with mineral aggregate, we will continue to add value to the region and to our state and to help our economy with new intelligent business such as bioscience and medical technology. We will also ensure that this area is redesigned and redeveloped carefully and considering the environment. We have worked very hard for over 10 years in this particular area of our community, this 1,700-acre site, and we have worked with the property owners in rezoning the area, and we have also talked with the county. And I believe that a resolution from the county is in your packet showing their support of our initiative to come here and to ask for your help to partner with us and to allow us to have the tools to help redevelop the area and expand the opportunities for not only Burnsville but for the region and for the state. Tammy Omdahl, our Deputy City Manager and Chief Financial Officer, will talk more about the details of the plan. Tammy.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tammy Omdahl from the City of Burnsville. I have about 5 minutes of material to cover. Hopefully in your packets you have a copy of a presentation. I will be brief in going through this. Real quickly, as the Senator and Mayor mentioned, we are proposing a project area in size of 1,700 acres. It's located directly south of the Minnesota River, bordered by 35W on the east, Highway 13 on the south, and the Scott County border on the west. The area has been an area of heavy industrial use since the 1950s, really. There are three landfills. One of those landfills, owned by Waste Management, remains active. There's a large limestone quarry in that 1,700 acres. Stockpiling, outdoor storage, and significant areas of poor soil conditions. We do not believe that contamination is present, but significant amount of peat in the area. The quarry located in this project area is 350 acres. It is currently being mined. After that use ceases to exist and operations end, it will become a 350-acre groundwater-fed lake. The city has plans with assistance from the state that was approved last session to build a treatment plant that will treat surface water from that lake. In addition, one of the three landfills that is closed, the freeway landfill, is an area that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has been working on for many years to seek final closure of that landfill to their standards. That has not been accomplished yet. We believe having this tax increment tool will allow the city to help facilitate final closure of that landfill. One remaining active landfill owned by Waste Management is approximately 300 acres in size. It has accepted waste since the 1950s. We anticipate that it will remain in operations and is approved for capacity for the next 10 to 15 years, and at that time operations will cease. In addition, in the project area, there's a methane collection facility, cement processing, compost facility. The city has worked for a long time with existing landowners and property owners in the area on a long-term vision for this area. And I mention this because those heavy industrial uses will continue to exist until either capacity is reached at the landfill or the quarry mining ends at the quarry. Rezoning was adopted in 2002, so that is already in place. And I would mention that the landfills, the quarry, and the stockpiling are permitted interim uses, so the city is not, in seeking this legislation, trying to push those heavy industrial areas out of uses out of the area. They will continue until they no longer are able to use the resources in the area. One of the reasons that we are seeking this legislation is because of the need for public infrastructure in the project area. We estimate about $160 million of public improvements are needed in order to help to facilitate redevelopment in this area. The current market value of the 1,700 acres of the developable area is $73 million. We anticipate, and have spent a lot of time looking at it, if this legislation were to pass, we estimate value will reach about $675 million based upon conceptual plans that are already adopted for the Minnesota River Quadrant. Three areas of legislation that we are seeking. The first one, because the life of the existing interim land uses significantly affect timing of redevelopment, we are seeking an extension of the 5-year rule under state law. The area, as I mentioned, has minimal public infrastructure in place, and because of that, we are seeking the ability to pool TIF across the project area and to finance those public improvements that are needed. And then last, we are seeking legislation, enabling legislation, that would allow us to create TIF districts for poor soil conditions. As I mentioned, we do not believe contamination is present, and therefore we don't have the ability to create TIF districts for that purpose. In closing, we believe the legislation would allow us to begin to address the $160 million of public improvements that are needed. Looking at what we anticipate could be generated in tax increment over that period of time is about half that amount. So even if this legislation passes, the city, the county, still has work to do with respect to financing those infrastructures because of the significant challenge and improvements that are needed. And last, as our mayor mentioned, with a rare exception, the county board did pass, Dakota County Board passed a resolution in support of this legislation, recognizing that but for this, we do not have the means to finance and pay for the public improvements that are needed and to seek the type of redevelopment that this land 15 miles from downtown would dictate. So with that, Mr. Chair, we stand for questions.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mayor and Director, how many years have you come with this proposal? Is this the second year?
This is the second year.
And we thank you, Senator Johnson, for your support last year because we got a unanimous approval on this, and here we are again. But so thank you so much for your support.
And Mr. Chair.
Look for it again this year. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Mayor, what happened to the bill last year?
Council?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson was included in the Senate Omnibus Tax Bill, but it was not finally adopted.
Thank you. Thanks for coming again.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair.
Hope your first experience with the tax committee was pleasurable, at least.
Mr. Chairman.
They won't all be this easy.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Did you want to make a motion to include it? Or?
The chair, without objection, will move that Senate File 999 be laid over for possible inclusion. Senator Skoy.
Yeah, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world.
Do you know what I'm having a problem? This agenda's on. I don't know what testifier's name.
Senator Skoy has Senate File 869.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am here with Senate File 869. This is a bill that would extend the exemption on motor vehicle registration taxes for ambulances. Currently in rural areas where they're servicing a very large area, there would be a need for having vehicles that carry the same equipment as ambulances and travel to the scene of an emergency that needs first responders to transport that equipment there. The first responders would then use the equipment to stabilize the individuals until an ambulance is able to arrive. And we were asking the committee to consider extending the same tax provisions to those vehicles as ambulances have. I'm here with Mr. Doyle, the Minnesota Ambulance Association, and he would like to provide further information and assist in answering questions.
Mr. Doyle, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is O.J. Doyle, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I think Senator Skoyd did a very good job of explaining what the issue is. With our scarce resources in rural Minnesota in particular, it's much easier to have a single person, trained emergency medical personnel, in a vehicle who may be teaching classes or doing other things within the service area. A call comes in, they may be closer than the ambulance, they can respond. They are really doing emergency medical care, but because of a technicality in the law, they are not considered an ambulance for tax purposes. That's it. We would appreciate your support.
Question from members of the committee. Senator Skoy, anything further?
Mr. Chair, it's just in this time of scarce resources, this does assist rural areas with the first responder needs that they have, and I would appreciate the committee's support.
Any questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundrum.
Good idea.
Senator Sundrum, great minds think alike. The chair thinks so, too. Senator Skoy, is a good idea?
I think this is a very good idea.
Without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 869 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Senator Youngbauer in the room?
Mm-mm. Not yet.
Senator Carlson? Should we deal with Thompson West? Senate File 897, sales tax exemption. Senator Carlson, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We have an opportunity here for a partnership. The partnership is Senate File 897, and what it does is it brings to my city, the city of Eagan, an investment, a major investment in an expansion at the Thompson West facility. Thompson West has about just a little bit under a quarter of a square mile in Eagan, and at present they have about 6,800 employees there. This is a company that pays well. This is a company that pays its employees, has health care, has a lot of employee amenities on the site. This is a company that has given land worth about $5 million to the YMCA nearby. This is a company that pays its taxes, stays off the business pages with bad news. This is a company that does everything right. It works with its community very well. It empowers its employees, and it provides flexible hours, provides telecommuting in some cases. And it has a lot of awards, like the 100 best places to work in IT from Computer World for six consecutive years, 100 best companies for working mothers, best employers for workers over 50 from AARP. Joining with me here today, I have several folks who can who will be backing up this this provision that we're showing you, where there's an exemption for the sales taxes paid on materials and the facilities to build this investment. It's not filling up empty space. This is to build new space and to fill it with these high-paying jobs. I have Mr. Rick King, Executive Vice President and Chief Operations Officer from Thompson West's North American Legal Division. I have Mr. Harry Melander from St. Paul Building and Trades Council. I have the Mayor, Mr. Mike McGuire from the City of Eagan. And we also have folks that are in the audience here, such as Tom Eagan, Dakota County Commissioner, Tom Hedges, City Administrator, Brent Richardson, Dakota County City Administrator. I'm sorry, Dakota County Administrator. We have the CEO from Dakota Electric, a partner in this endeavor, Mr. Greg Miller. We have Margaret Schreiner, the chair of the board of Dakota Electric. And then if we need any additional comments on the indirect jobs, we have Mr. Gene Goddard from DEED. So with that, I'm going to introduce Mr. Rick King, who will give you the details of the expansion.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Bach and committee members. My name is Rick King. I'm the Executive Vice President and Chief Operations Officer at Thompson West in Eagan. Today, I'm pleased to be before you to talk a little bit about our company, about the job and campus growth that's proposed, and about the strong economic benefits that come from them. Many of you may know that West was started in St. Paul in 1872, so it has a rich 135-year history here. And primarily, it was a book legal publisher, and you may still know it as that. We still do a fair amount of book publishing. But today, over 70% of our revenues are electronic. So we do a lot of books as well as electronic work. We provide information and workflow solutions for attorneys in the U.S. Legal market, most prominently through a product online called Westlaw, which many of you may know. Thompson acquired West Publishing in 1996, and at that time and still, the Eagan campus and the West business both remain the largest campus and the largest business within the Thompson world. The growth here in jobs in Minnesota relates directly to the high caliber of workforce that we can get, as well as the quality of life. We're able to attract good people. Over the last 10 years, we have added 1,400 high-paying jobs in our Eagan facility. We're now at 6,800 people in the 271-acre campus. 1,400 of those are technology people, 800 are attorneys, and many other professionals are there as well. What we're asking for is part in the partnership that's described is a sales tax exemption on the construction and pieces of the expansion for approximately $9 million. The expansion is scheduled to bring 2,000 jobs by the end of 2012. These are exactly the kind of jobs that every state would want to attract. They're technology jobs, they're software engineers, they're high tech, they're brain power jobs. The average salary of these jobs is $70,000 per year. By the end of 2012, these jobs will bring an annual payroll of $150 million in terms of an increase to our business, in addition to the payroll that we already have, which is over $400 million a year. We pay over $30 million a year in Minnesota taxes, all in payroll, unemployment insurance, real estate taxes, sales taxes on purchase, and corporate income taxes. So as you can see, we contribute heavily, and we like to contribute that way. The investments that we've asked for here are recovered in about 4 years just through these taxes. As you can see in the packet, the overall investment that we're planning on doing is over $100 million in capital. It will bring 500,000 square feet of office and data center space to our campus. This is a significant addition to the campus, and in addition to the jobs that I've mentioned already, we'll furnish 350,000 person hours in construction jobs. Nearly 200 workers will be working on the actual construction. We think this is a very important partnership. Minnesota is an excellent place to live and an excellent place to do business. We've got a solid business here, and we want to expand here. The expansion for us must make economic sense. The cost of creating 2,000 jobs in Minnesota or anywhere else, of course, is substantial, and we're looking at that over $100 million investment because we plan to stay. The board approved, contingent on the state's part of the partnership, the facility expansion as I've described here. But for the board, we also need to maintain our cost competition, and this incentive package is critical in terms of the board's deliberation and decision. We need to have this partnership going forward. The expansion is very important, and I think the expansion for the state and for our business is Minnesota's to keep. Without the partnership, we would be back to the board and we'd have to look at an open competition. These are exactly the kind of jobs, as I said, that I think you would want going into the future. The technology industry is going to equal the agriculture, financial services, and medical device industry going forward. These are the brain power jobs that we want to have in Minnesota. Minnesota wants to be a brain power state. Thompson is a brain power company, and this expansion allows the state of Minnesota to solidify its position. We would appreciate your support for this expansion and your support in helping to bring these 2,000 additional well-paying knowledge workers to Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today and look forward to any questions that you might have for us. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, what we'll do is we will have our speakers speak and then ask that questions be held until the third speaker speaks. So with that, I'm going to introduce Mr. Harry Melander, the Executive Secretary of the St. Paul Building and Construction Trades Council.
Morning. Chairperson Bach, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I am the Executive Secretary of the St. Paul Building Trades Council. Our organization represents 14,000 well-trained, safe construction workers that derive their income from projects like this. Construction projects like the one that Thompson West is proposing are important not only to Twin City economy but Minnesota, especially important to the construction industry that folks that I represent work in. Our industry employs men and women who pay taxes, have health insurance, raise their families, and buy services in the metropolitan area and outside. The Thompson West Eagan campus expansion will require, as earlier stated, 350,000 work hours for construction. This is a significant project that will provide good-paying jobs for building trades people over the next 2 years. At any time in the course of this building project, nearly 200 building trades members will work on this site at Thompson West. Our organization and its employers have had a long-standing relationship with Thompson West and look forward to this opportunity. This project will include occupations such as electricians, carpenters, painters, plumbers, pipe fitters, and other highly skilled building trades members. We have a strong history with this Thompson West group. In fact, in 1990, West has invested over $170 million in construction expansion. The most recent data center project in Eagan in 2005 required 160 work hours and provided work for over 200 building trades members. We are anxious to partner once again with Thompson West to build a facility that will provide necessary space to an estimated 2,000 employees by the end of 2012. We hope that the committee moves this forward and appreciates the opportunity this morning, Chairman Bach, to address the group.
Thank you, Mr. Melander.
Mr. Chair and committee members, now I would like to introduce Mr. Mike McGuire from the City of Eagan.
Chair Bach, Larry.
Members.
Good morning. My name is Mike McGuire. I am the mayor of Eagan.
I want to thank you for taking the time to consider this project that is so important to our state and to my community of Eagan as well. Amid today's talk about revenues and incentives, I'd like to talk to you just a little bit about some of the contributions that Thompson West makes to our community. Thompson West has a tradition of partnering with our community for everyone's benefit. Thompson West works with our schools, loaning equipment to the middle schoolers at Scott Highland Middle School to get them up and running in real-time video conferencing. The students of School District 196 benefit when Thompson West makes slots in its leadership training programs available to school district staff and teachers as well. Thompson contributed classroom equipment to our City of Eagan's efforts to help schools who were victim of Hurricane Katrina, by contributing technological classroom equipment for those schools as well. Thompson employees are also authorized to volunteer on the Eagan Volunteer Fire Department during the day, which is a critical time for us to have volunteers and often do not have as many volunteers as we need to have on staff and ready to go. Thompson West has also been a critical part of my city's technological task force, not just contributing staff to participate on the task force that helps our city look at how to keep Eagan and the state of Minnesota competitive in the technological field, but it's facilitated video conferences with industry leaders in the Netherlands. It has shared advanced analysis of the latest trends and strategies in the area of broadband communication. And just recently, Thompson West flew a world's leading expert on fiber optic deployment, and that person took some time to meet with our technology task force as well. I might add that I recently opened helped to open a Goodwill store, and on that grand opening, the volunteer staff were predominantly Thompson West employees as well. Thompson's 6,800 knowledge workers may make it the state's largest software developer, but they are an important member and a contributor to our community. The 2,000 high-wage technology jobs that this project will bring brain power to our state and take advantage of the solid workforce that we already have. Each of those jobs will be people who will pay taxes and spend money, but they will also buy homes and keep our state and our community strong. I ask that as you consider this partnership with Thompson West that you recognize the great contributions that they make to our state and to my community of Eagan. Again and again, Thompson, and before it West Publishing, has made investments in Minnesota. One way or another, I'd respectfully ask and encourage you to partner with Thompson West and make an investment in Minnesota as well. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
With that, Mr. Chair, we would entertain any questions.
Mr. King, I understand the project is going to be phased over several years. Can you show us on the map kind of what the phasing of the project looks like? I mean, what's going to get built first? And I mean,
sure.
I understand you're making a commitment to add 2,000 jobs. I'm interested in kind of how the staging of that goes. I mean, if the data center is going to be open by November 07, which I think is what I read in the press release, how many jobs is that, and which part of the facility is that?
Mr. Chair, may I ask another person to come up and help do some pointing here?
Sure, certainly.
Mr. Chairman, it is our hope to begin the data center activity as soon as we have a positive result from the legislature.
Mr. King, on that point, let me just say, I looking at your press release, I thought it said April 07. I just want to make sure that you and your board understand that this legislature, the adjournment date is likely right around the 20th of May. So there really will be no for certain decision until that date. So I don't know how that affects your construction schedule, but That's just kind of the timing of the legislative session. I just want to make you aware of that.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Since the release was made, I certainly have become more aware of the schedules that are driving some of these activities. And as we see it today, business demand continues to increase. We don't anticipate starting that construction until after the legislative closure date. We'll continue to monitor the business situation to make sure that we can do that, because we do have increasing demands and needs in the data center. But that is our anticipation, that we would begin construction post the legislative session. Now, to that point, the data center itself is probably home to approximately 5 of the jobs that would be created in this activity. The office campus expansion is the driver for the employment expansion, and those are jobs that use the equipment and so forth that are in the data center, but they aren't directly working in the data center. Today's data centers tend to be have a very light amount of staff, but they are utilized by people around the world. Tom can point to where the data center expansion is going to be, and that certainly would be the first thing that we would begin to start on the campus. And then we would move to the building expansion activities that are there, which would extend our office facilities and so forth. That would be the sequence of events.
And the office square footage would be added when?
The office square footage, the starting date is August of 2007 would be the construction start.
So the two projects would run concurrently?
That's correct.
There's several different pieces of information I saw said that you currently employ 6,800, and some said more than 6,800. What's the number of people really that work at Thompson West today?
Mr. Chairman, the number of people is 6,800 today on the Eagan campus, give or take 2 or 3 that may be hired as we speak.
Okay.
We have currently, just so you know, about 120 jobs open and posted, so the number can fluctuate a little bit, but we are definitely over 6,800.
And the capital investment for the project, all the information I read says that Thompson West is going to spend $100 million on this campus expansion. But I'm a little confused, because in the bill, members, we say that the investment is at least $60 million. I'm just wondering why Mr. King or maybe the author can tell me, if the intent is to spend $100 million on this expansion, why would we make Thompson West eligible for the benefits of the bill at a $60 million investment?
Mr. Chairman, I can speak to the investment that we plan to make. As you will see from the release, I think the term over $100 million is used. I believe that the labor part of that and the actual construction costs and so forth, if you added them all up, I think the number will come quite a bit higher than $100 million, but over $100 million is the number that we're using. I can't speak to why the $60 million it is in the bill per se, and I might, you know, suggest that the senator could speak to that. But I can tell you that the numbers that we see with the total project are going to be nearly twice the $100 million.
Mr. Chair,
Sarah Langston.
Well, Mr. Chair, the labor cost wouldn't have a sales tax on them, so it'd be just the capital cost. So that's probably where the $60 million comes in.
Mr. Chair, I might be able to add a little bit of clarification. This project has been enlarged as time went on. The $60 million, if I remember correctly, was a number that was placed into the bill when the initial discussions were spoken of. Typically, again,
you know, like Senator Langseth mentioned, that there's capital investment for materials, and there's the labor. And of course, there is not a sales tax on labor. And typically, I think you could probably say that the ratio is about 60-40 materials to labor. So when we talk, when we fix a $100 million project, we start out with a $60 million material purchase. Well, now that material purchase appears to be going up to get the maximum number of jobs, and we're actually looking at a minimum of $100 million. So the sales tax exemption is a potential for much higher investment. And, of course, the sales tax is a number that comes strictly from the purchases of materials, too.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Squire.
Mr. Chair, to that point, I just was following along with what you're talking about. If you take 6.5% of $60 million, you don't come up to the $8.9 million that's in the fiscal note. So something is out of balance there.
Senator Carlson, I think we have a little bit of work to do on the numbers. I think to get 6.5% of the total, we can't get to what's in the fiscal note with the $60 million number in the bill. I'm just wondering if the $60 million bill in the bill needs to be higher.
Mr. Chair, Senator Squire, I'm going to ask Mr. King to explain some of the numbers.
Mr. King? Chair, Senator, quite right. The number is, I believe the number that would be eligible for sales tax exemption would come close to $140 million. But as I said, our number in the press release simply said over $100 million because we needed to get to more detail. I think the fix that we would have on that today is about $140 million, and then the labor would go on top of that. So the project is significantly more, but the part that would equal the sales tax exemption we currently see at $140 million. And clearly, the sales tax exemption would be for whatever is purchased. So if there was less than $140 million, it would apply to that. And if it was more, it would apply to that during that period of time. I believe that from my view, the $60 million perhaps was a minimal number that was placed in there at some time, but to me has nothing to do today with the current project. We are saying again that we're planning to spend over $100 million. That's what we've said publicly, and I'm giving you detail today that say the sales tax exemption will apply to something closer to $140 million worth of purchases.
So Mr. King, if that's true, if in putting this bill together we were to change $60 million to $100 million, do you think that would be fair?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's fair.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be a question for Mayor McGuire or Senator Carlson. In the overview of proposed incentives, it references $1.5 million in highway upgrades. Can you explain that incentive? And is that an advance by MnDOT? Is it moving the project up? What's the nature of that subsidy?
Chair, Senator Larson, the Highway 149 highway upgrade has been part of our capital improvement project in the city of Eagan for a number of years. It is scheduled to actually begin independent, this expansion, this spring. That is a project that is ongoing. Any members of the Transportation Committee are aware that we've been talking about that project a lot as well. But as part of that project, there is also an intersection improvement at the intersection of Highway 149 and Opperman Drive, right at the entrance of the Eagan campus for Thompson West. And that's an intersection improvement that actually Thompson West has agreed to take on 100% of the special assessment costs for that intersection upgrade as well. Hope that answers your questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mayor McGuire. The reason I ask is, I guess that makes sense, that that's the portion of the project that's related to the to the new development, although it's sort of, as it's booked here, as part of the state's investment. So if Thompson's picking that up, perhaps.
The state is participating, Chair and Senator Larson, in the overall Highway 149 upgrade project. I believe that contribution is what's being framed there.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could one of the testifiers point out what's already developed on that map? I'm not sure about how old this company is.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, the parts that are in red are the new to be expanded pieces, and the parts that are shown in the darker gray are the current facility as it is.
Mr. Chairman, how many buildings does that comprise already? What's already built and developed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, from a number of buildings per se or from a square footage point of view?
Please.
Both. Let me get the information about the square footage from Tom. 2.6 million square feet. That would be office space and data center. There are three physical buildings, one data center that's apart from the main campus, one building that houses generators, and then the main campus is all contiguous as one very large building. So that today houses the bulk of the employees.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with I'm assuming that this is a current TIF district that you mentioning the tax increment financing in your economic incentive proposal. How many years is left of that, Mr. Mayor? Do you know?
Chair, Senator Scoy, that is not an existing TIF district. At this time, there is also legislation, I believe, proposed to enable the city to participate in designating a TIF district. But that has not happened yet, and so it's not an existing TIF district. When it is an existing TIF district, if we get to that point, I believe it's proposed to be a 9-year TIF district.
Senator Carlson, has the TIF bill been drafted yet?
It has just been drafted for the House, and we're going to be jacketing it, I believe, today or tomorrow. It will be another bill that I'll be carrying, and in fact, the as Mayor McGuire mentioned, the city still has to act on it, and that is on the agenda for tonight for the city meeting.
Senator Squay, to that.
Mr. Chair, I was just the point is TIF districts aren't always so easy to get either, you know, but we'll take a look at what it is, I guess.
Mr. King, when this bill was the Senator Metzen's committee members did a for discussion purposes overview of this bill because of the employment impacts. And I, as a member of that committee, was a little bit confused about, I think I left the room with most members, a little confused about how many jobs we were really going to create. There was, I think, a little, and I think Senator Carlson would agree, I think that committee was a little uncertain about how many new employees we're going to have. Mr. King, how many new employees are we going to have after we spend this $100 million that's in here, and are we pretty sure we're going to get there?
Mr. Chair, my apologies for not being clearer before that committee. And I'll
maybe it was just me, but I don't think I was alone.
I will do my best to be clearer. We're planning to add 2,000 jobs to Minnesota via this particular investment. There are a number of these jobs that will be moved from other locations in the United States. The majority of them, 60%, will be net new, brand new jobs. The other ones will be through consolidations and also different types of acquisitional growth that we'll have during that period. But the total is 2,000.
Are we pretty sure, Mr. King, it's not 1,800? Pretty sure?
All the projections that we have home in right on 2,000, and I would just say that past performance in terms of developing jobs in Eagan in the state is perhaps the best indicator of future performance. And we've added 1,400 jobs since 1995. I think that's more than we planned to add, more than we thought we were going to add, so we exceeded our expectation. And it would be our plan in everything that we talk about to always meet or exceed our expectations.
So, Mr. King, would it be okay if this committee asked you to report back in 2012 about how many jobs we really got? Would you be willing to do that?
Mr. Chair, we'd be pleased to report back to you in 2012, or before if you wish.
How soon could you report back? There's attorneys out there looking for work. I know there is. they're watching.
I believe that were we to start as per our plan, I would think that within 2 years after the beginning of the project, we could come back and give you meaningful reports.
Thank you. I think that would be helpful. Anything else, members of the committee?
Mr. Chair, if I might add just a bit more, I would like to bring up Mr. Gene Goddard to just make a couple of comments about the job analysis that has been done by DEED. Mr. Goddard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gene Goddard. I'm a business development specialist for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'm the lead staff for major projects that happen within the state for the department. As part of our analysis of job creation that will be taking part of this major expansion that's proposed by Thompson, we also did a REMI model, which is a economic modeling statistical program that we use to analyze company growth and how that will impact the community. Based upon the 2,000 jobs that they've been telling us since we started working with them in August that would be part of this expansion, we looked at the number of indirect jobs that would be created, the number of jobs that are created by companies that support or supply services and goods to Thompson. We looked at the number of induced jobs that would be created as part of this project, which result from the expenditures that the employees spend their wages and their income into the local economy. And we also looked at the total job impact. Currently, of the 6,800 employees that Thompson has at their facility, those folks live in over 31 counties within the state of Minnesota, with the largest populations being in Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Washington, and Scott. But 31 counties send their employees to work at this campus. So looking at our analysis, we've determined from the 2,000 direct jobs that Thompson will create, will be just under 3,000, actual numbers, 2,904 indirect jobs, which would be the supplier companies to Thompson, and 1,977 jobs that would be created by the induced expenditures by the employees spending their household incomes, with a total net job creation by 2013 to the state of 6,881. So we feel that this impact of this 2,000 jobs, the high wages that they would create, will be a significant impact on the growth of the metro area and the 31 counties that their employees currently come from.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, is this the last stop for this? Oh, this is just the sales tax exemption?
Correct.
So is this project not going to any other committee, Mr. Chair?
Senator Moore, there was a hearing in the Jobs Committee and Senator Metzen's committee. Even though the bill was in the possession of the tax committee, they held an informational hearing on this bill in the Jobs and Business Committee.
And Mr. Chair, is the Transportation Committee, do you know, are they going to hold an informational hearing on the transportation impact?
Senator Moore, looking at the language in the bill, I don't know why they would.
Okay.
I mean, they may want to on the TIF provisions. I don't know what's in the TIF provisions that the TIF will pay for. I suspect there's some transportation-related stuff to the TIF.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, on the Highway 149 upgrade, how is that being funded by MnDOT?
I'm gonna ask Mr. McGuire to answer that.
Chair, Senator Moore, the Highway 149 upgrade is a $7 million project that has been on in the City of Eagan's capital improvement project again for a number of years. The state is participating, and I believe the $1.5 million is correct. through its ordinary participation on a state highway upgrade. The State Highway 149 was slated for upgrade prior to, far prior to, the announcement of the expansion here at the Thompson West site.
And, Mr. Mayor, the balance of the money in addition to MnDOT will come from?
Chair, I appreciate the question. A portion of it will come from federal funding. The lion's share of it, unfortunately, will be coming from the City of Eagan because the upgrade is so desperately needed. The city has had to step up and absorb the cost increases on that project. I believe we are participating out of that $7 million, and I'm rough with my numbers, so I apologize. I believe the City of Eagan is participating to the tune of about $4 million out of that $7 million, and that is, again, on State Highway 149.
On a state highway, Mr. Mayor.
Indeed, Chair Bob.
Do you think that's right that in Eagan the city has to put that kind of money into the improvements of a state highway?
Chair Bark, I do not.
Mr. Mayor, what city is the governor from?
Chair Bach, I believe he is a constituent of mine in Eagan.
Mr. Chair, can I do one more follow-up?
On
the deed loan for the Minnesota Investment Fund loan, the $2 million, are those forgivable loans?
At this point, we have $1 million in our existing budget that it will be a forgivable loan to this project. The additional funding, $2 million that we have above, so a total of $3 million out of the Minnesota Investment Fund. That $2 million is part of our governor's proposal for the budget this year. That has yet to be negotiated, whether that will be a forgivable or repayment loan. We have to go, because of the confidential issues that we've had with the city on this, that we have not brought that before the city council for their approval on that additional $2 million, and that will take place at an upcoming hearing with the city council. So the first $1 million is forgivable. The second $2 million is yet to be negotiated.
And
Mr. Mayor, let me give you a tip. There is a way that the City of Eagan can have that money revolve back to them if it's a loan, so you can do other highway projects in your district or or in your community or other economic development projects. The Minnesota Investment Fund does do things like that, and it might be an additional revenue stream for the City of Eagan if you're a good negotiator with deed. Senator Bois.
Mr. Chair, and maybe some people here know this better than I haven't run into this. Why would we structure something as a forgivable loan as opposed to just kind of an outright grant if that's the intent anyways?
Mr. Chair, Senator, because the statutory guidelines for how the Minnesota Investment Fund program is designed, we cannot make a direct grant to a company, so we make it as a forgivable loan. So we work as a loan document, and that allows us to do clawback provisions as well. So if the company does not create the jobs that they project that they will, we can use the loan documents as a way to take back the asset or to accelerate the loan so that the company then needs to pay us back for the failure for them to create the jobs that they said that they were going to.
Mr. Goddard, why do I seem to remember that the Minnesota Investment Fund has a $500,000 cap per project on it?
Mr. Chair, it used to have a $500,000 cap. When we converted the loan program from a repaying back to the general fund into a revolving loan fund in 2002, I believe it was, we changed the cap at that point to $1 million.
And if the cap is one, Thompson West is going to get how much?
They'll get $1 million, and then under the governor's proposal to increase the funding to the Minnesota Investment Fund to $7 million in the current governor's budget proposal, we have language in there to target $2 million out of that $7 million to this project.
Outside of the regular normal program criteria?
Correct, sir.
From members of the committee? Thank you, Mr. Goddard. Thank you, Mr. King, Mr. Mayor, and Senator Carlson. Without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 897 for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rest here. Senator Rust, maybe if we could, I don't think Senator Youngbar will take very long, and if we could, Senator Youngbar, how long will you take? Okay, I think Senator Rust's bill is probably going to take considerably longer than that.
I like to have short bills.
Thank you, Senator Rust.
I'll try to do it in 2 minutes. I'm sorry, Senator Rust.
Senator Youngbar, if you had been here on time, you'd have been out of here long ago.
Well, I apologize, Mr. Chair, members, because I was out of town at a wastewater convention last week and came home to the snowstorm. My whole schedule is kind of in a ruin. But I did learn everything that's going on with wastewater in the state of Minnesota, both large systems and small systems, if that's a help. So,
Senator Youngbar, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you.
Tell us about Senate File 884 and why we should do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Member, Senate File 884 is a simple tax increment financing authority for the city of Anoka around their transit substation for the North Star Corridor. So they're asking for this authority subject to Minnesota statute and everything as outlined within our request here to redevelop an area for the transit substation for the North Star Corridor at the city of Anoka. So I think it's pretty simple, straightforward. I'm open for questions. Is that quick enough?
Wait. Senator Youngbar, how come this can't be done by the city without special legislation? What are the special circumstances that we need a special bill?
Well, it's my understanding, Mr. Chair and members, that to do this kind of a redevelopment, that it's a commonplace thing to come to the legislature and ask for the permission to do it. I was told by the city of Anoka, and I don't think they got the message to be here today either in my getting my schedule goofed up. We did a similar thing for the city of Ramsey last year around a redevelopment for the North Star Corridor. And I was told that basically the same thing, that it's a commonplace thing to come and ask for permission to do these things, and that there was some slight difference we were asking for based on the redevelopment. We need to acquire some properties that are already developed, and I was informed by the city of Anoka that it was a requirement to get approval from the legislature to do it.
Senator Youngbar, I was always, I don't know, in following this whole North Star Corridor issue, there was a lot of talk about all the development that's going to happen along this line, and there's going to be all these hubs and whole new development projects are going to spring up. You know, when we talked about that back in the House a number of years ago, and that issue's been around a long time, I didn't envision we were going to use tax increment financing to make all these new developments along that corridor happen.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a good point. Within the bulk of my district, along the North Star Corridor, I have the city of Anoka, the city of Ramsey, the city of Elk River. And within the city of Anoka and Elk River, it's old established cities. Typically what's along the rail yard actually would go up there is just older rail hubs. Within the city of Anoka, you have things like Gross Line Beverage. There's feed mills along the rail, so they would like to redevelop it. The businesses out there believe that a lot of newer upper-level businesses would be there. You know, whenever you develop initially, you get kind of an entry-level business, and then things tear up and get redeveloped over time. Ramsey has a big city center. They're a newer, wide-open area. That's what they were trying to do, was accomplish a city center in order to get a different type of a development there. But otherwise, between Anoka and Elk River, it's pretty wide open land. And as you get north of Elk River, it's all wide open in terms of areas that have been developed along there for the anticipating the North Star Corridor, new development, but mostly wide open for brand new stuff to come in. But again, older cities like Anoka and Elk River, it's moving on to that second and third level of redevelopment.
Senator Youngbar, in this redevelopment around this transit system in the city of Anoka, what kind of businesses do you think are going to locate there?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not certain what Anoka is envisioning attracting there. There's quite a number of businesses along the Highway 10 corridor, and the North Star corridor parallels the Highway 10 corridor. So just in talking to my business owners over the last 4 years, they envision more manufacturing, more office-type complexes that can get people in and out on a transit-oriented type of subdivision or commercial divisions where people could, you know, say, locate down in Coon Rapids where there's a station, ride out to Anoka. Today it's designed basically to bring people from the outer ring suburbs in, and what businesses are actually anticipating and talking about and being excited about is as we move more towards transit-oriented development, they picture more high-density housing around the North Star Corridor, people that can ride in, but they're actually hoping to locate newer type of office complexes down there where their people would not even have to get on the highway but could get on the commuter rail and then, you know, locate directly around these substations and literally walk from the station to work.
Senator Youngbar, it'll be more than coffee shops?
More than coffee shops, yes. The city of Ramsey and the city center, Mr. Chair and members, it's a transit-oriented subdivision, has a park ride, a municipal parking ramp. Originally, Ramsey was slated to get a substation for the North Star Corridor. In the primary phase, it will not get one, but they have a bus stop there. It's high density, but the new commercial that you're seeing more and more in all of our cities is commercial located at the base level of the buildings and then residential condominium type things above the commercial. So yes, the coffee shops are going to be there, but they envision more and more office complexes, medical complexes, things where the people would not necessarily have to get on our roads. And, you know, I always want to stay on our road, Mr. Chair, but I'd be just happy if we could get a bunch of people off the road so I'd have more room to drive my car.
Senator Johnson, what do you think is going to get built there?
Mr. Chairman, I am just surprised that Senator Youngbauer doesn't have a table full of testifiers. This is a 150-year-old community, and I'm a member of the chamber there. They are very energetic, very hardworking, very motivated people to keep their quaint little town, you know, kind of like a maybe feeling like Stillwater, you know, just they really are energetic and they really do have some good plans. I'm not trying to support Senator Youngbauer's bill, but I'm just kind of surprised that, you know, you don't have the chamber here and some economic types here.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I don't know what happened to my schedule. We've been having problems with certain things that get sent to us on email never showing up. So I got a call at 8:30 this morning that says, oh, by the way, you're on the schedule this morning. We've been trying to figure out with our Senate information people what's going on, but we've...
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to speak on behalf of the city of Anoka then. They really, really would do a good job with this.
I think it's a good bill, Senator Johnson?
I think that's up to Senator Youngbauer to champion.
Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, I would
defer. What kind of coffee do you have today?
The cheapest I could find, Mr. Chair. Senator Youngbauer, I'm leery of TIF districts and growing communities, and your county has significant growth, does it not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, our county has significant growth. In my understanding of TIF districts, being a mayor, before I was a state senator, was that this is exactly what TIF money is all about. It's about redevelopment. Some cities use it for brand new development, and looking back at statutory authority, it was always my understanding as a mayor that TIF districts were only on rare occasions to be used for new development, but always to be used for redeveloping into your second or third level of development within the city.
Senator Ortman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's why it would be good to have members of your community here so that they could make the case about what these dollars were going to be used for. Just from my own experience, I was not on the city council in Chanhassen, but we have regretted ever since the tax increment financing that we did in the city of Chanhassen. When we were going to demand goods and services and businesses in that community, but we were trying to think ahead, did the TIF development, and we ended up not collecting taxes on significant properties, and they ended up being Target and some other big companies that now are, you know, members of our community but did not pay taxes for a very long time, and we ended up being upside down on our TIF and needed a state buyout. And so for me personally, as a member of this committee, I'd like to visit with your members of your community to talk with them about what they have in mind and are, you know, making sure that they understand the ramifications of the legislation that you've proposed And so I would feel much more comfortable supporting it had they been here this morning, and maybe you could ask to lay this bill over and reschedule it for a day when you can have them here.
Senator Ortman, do you think 95 acres is too big? In the bill on line 11. 95 acres too big? I don't know.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what's proposed. I mean, Senator Jungbar was talking about the development around the transit station, but I'd surely like to see what's been proposed. I would guess that the plans are a little bit more elaborate and could be very persuasive.
Senator Watt?
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to Senator Jungbar if he wants to answer, but I have a different question.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, as you can see in Section 3 under Subdivision 3, it actually talks specifically about what's envisioned under this TIF proposal is to actually land acquisition costs, pedestrian, vehicle, transit improvements, other public improvements as they're proposed to the rail station. So it's very specific within this bill what they're trying to ask for. Again, I would apologize. I don't know what's going on with our email system. We've only had it happen, but in several different committees now, we're not getting all our email notifications from some committees, so I don't know what's going on. We've asked SIS to figure it out.
Senator Jungbar, I think all of us have experienced that frustration. Senator Moore?
Mr. Chair, if Senator Jungbar chooses to lay this over until he has people come in to talk to us, that will be fine. If not, I have some concerns about the creation of a redevelopment district, and we are basically saying that they don't need to have substandard structures. And so I'm assuming that the area that they're looking or proposing to create the TIF district doesn't have infrastructure or structures in the area. And so part of what this bill, among other things, is trying to do is technically to do away with the requirement for blighted structure. And I'm not sure if that's the path that we want to go in, is to give these kind of – I think there are other exemptions in here, but that one exemption is of concern to me.
Senator Jungbar, I know a little something about the tax chair and the other body, and – she's not a huge fan of tax increment. So I think we're going to need some, if we're going to put this in a Senate bill, we're going to need some help making the argument. So if you think if we laid this over and put it on the agenda for Thursday, we could get somebody from the city in to help us make the argument why we should include it in the omnibus bill.
I would be happy to do that so that we can get out here, out of here, and also let Senator rest. I promised her that I'd be done quickly. So with all these questions, I'd be happy to lay it over till Thursday and get other people in.
Senator Jungbar, no email. Thursday morning, 8:30.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Okay.
Deal?
Sounds good.
I might want to add to the conversation we're having. I'm very familiar with Senator Jungbauer's district. It's adjacent to mine. I think when a city gets a little upside down on TIF, it's when they're growing. It's when they don't have all the infrastructure in, and all of a sudden TIF has been used to promote a commercial development that now impacts the area with growth, transportation demands are suddenly put into it. City of Rogers in my district is exactly like that. They even applied TIF to a Dairy Queen, unbelievably. But now they have a city that has a lot of people going through it. You got Cabela's, you got shopping malls, you got everything else. TIF attracted those type of businesses there. And the city can't keep up with the simple things like law enforcement. They don't have the revenues because they're not collecting anything via TIF. Now, Anoka is a little different. Anoka is a city that's been well established. It's got a large population. It's got the infrastructure in it that was adequate over the years, but now you have this new rail thing going through the city, and I don't think they're going to go upside down on TIF. They've got a very strong area and a strong economic commerce center that's doing it. However, this is a unique situation because it puts unique demands on a city trying to catch up to this new rail system that's coming through, and they're trying to attract a quality business that surrounds it within this district. It would be helpful, of course, to have the people here, but I wanted to just kind of put things into proper focus that I think this is a very legitimate use of TIF. And I'm anxious to hear the details on it on Thursday, but I just wanted to make that comment because, you know, you look at the city of Brooklyn Park, we've managed to put TIF into that. We've acquired rundown apartment complexes that have put a negative impact on that city. We've remodeled their commercial development on Brooklyn Boulevard, and it's now coming around. It's revitalizing itself. It's exactly what that city needed. And I think Anoka is also one of those towns and communities. They've been around for over 150 years, I think, in the state of Minnesota, and they just need a little help to catch up to the 21st century with that new rail coming through.
And Mr. Chair and members, I will tell the staff at Anoka to take some snapshots along the rail because I'm sure that all of the stuff currently barring the northwest end of the city meets the blighted requirement.
Senator Youngmar, you may have a very fine bill. We just don't know. I'm not familiar with what we're going to redevelop, and I think if we'll put you up first on Thursday, if you can have some people from the city and maybe some affected businesses or somebody from the chamber, I think that would be helpful to the committee.
We will be here, and I do apologize that I didn't get the communication in a timely manner. So,
Chair lays over Senate File 884 on the table. Thank you, Senator Youngbar, and the Chair's apologies, too, if our email system didn't adequately give you time to prepare. Senator Rest, I'm sorry. Please. Okay, now. Senator Youngbar's. Next time, members, Senator Youngbar says he needs 5 minutes.
Give him an hour.
Senator Rest, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was very interested, actually, in the discussion and was glad to be delayed. Tax increment is a favorite longtime subject of mine, and I just a couple of comments about that. I do think that if the Property Tax Committee has not had a hearing on the Citizens League report, which comes out annually on the use of TIF across the state. It just came out, I think, last week or so. And it's very interesting because it shows that even though there was a huge dip in 2001, 2002, after we passed the property tax reform and took away the state paying for the schools, and the penalty, the LGA penalty there, there was a huge dip, and then tax increments started climbing again. But in the last year, it's now showing a slight trend downward. So the appetite for using tax increment looks like it's beginning to decrease once again. Now, there are other economic development tools like the Jobs E-Zones and tax abatements and so on, but it's not all of the property tax relief that's given to businesses through TIF, subsidized by the cities, seems to be piling up in tax increment again. And also, certainly Chanhassen is a disaster for tax increment, but part of that is because they oversubscribe to it. They put like 50% of their tax base into TIF, and I would suggest that one of the things you need to look at for Anoka is how much of their tax base is in tax increment right now, in terms of what kinds of risks they're making. But I'm here to talk about capital equipment. We have, over the last dozen years or so, made real improvements in the not taxing the inputs of business in their capital equipment in manufacturers. Over the years, we've developed and don't have, I don't think we've been adding to it, but have a fully developed and very, very detailed description, definition of what qualifies as original inputs for manufacturers. The and we were able, through phasing it in through the 90s, to make sure that those business inputs were free from taxation, sales tax and taxation. What we were not able to do, however, was to change the refund to an upfront exemption. And every year for the last several years, there's been a whole bunch of people that come in with making being freed from sales tax, which exists right now, making it an exemption as opposed to a refund, but it costs a lot of money, and it's never been a high priority, and it even costs more money from the November forecast to the March forecast. I don't know if you've gotten the updated fiscal note, but it went from something like $74 million to $77 million in the next fiscal year if we accomplished an upfront exemption rather than the refund. And like some others who will nevertheless testify, and I invite them to come up in a moment, about how important this could be as a stimulus to their business and to cut through some the red tape of having to go through the refund process, we've never been able to look at it as something that's scalable. We were able to do the phase-in of the refund over a number of years because we could just say, well, this year they'll pay a little bit less, and next year they'll pay a little bit less, and we could do it over 7 or 8 years, and it was never a whole big pot of money in 1 year. But we've been boxed in by the notion that you either apply for a refund or you get an exemption, and it's either one or the other. And we haven't been engaged, which I hope we will start to be engaged, is there a different way to looking at scaling an exemption? And some of the things that have occurred to me, and I don't have any research on them yet, but I hope to be meeting with the manufacturers' groups to see if they are palatable to them, and also with the Department of Revenue. What if we did something like chose a couple of instances of the definition and say, okay, for the next 2 years, that part of the definition will get the upfront exemption and the rest will get a refund, have to apply for the refund. Using their industry codes would be another way of doing that. Or taking, for example, the 10 or 15 least populated counties in Minnesota and saying that we would start with those and give businesses that operate by and use it, we wouldn't want it to be bought in one county and used in another, but bought and used equipment for manufacturing in those counties, that they would get, the exemption could apply there, and everybody else would have to apply for a refund, and we would at least have a policy in place that we could add to over time as we could afford it, so that we wouldn't have to come in with a bill that says over a biennium that we want to spend $77 million in 1 year, and then it goes down over time anyway, but then some $65 million in the next biennium. So I would like to call the testifiers here to talk about an exemption on capital equipment, but also to let you know that I hope to be working with the stakeholders to see if there are ways of getting the policy in place at low cost and then seeing if over time we're able to benefit Minnesota businesses and maybe even use the exemption as a way of giving some sort of economic exemption incentive based on their location in the state of Minnesota. So that is what Senate File 117 is, and I believe that there are three or four other bills. It's a popular idea to support. It's good tax policy. It's just that it's a very expensive one when there are so many other needs and priorities. So, Mr. Chairman, members, if I could ask the testifiers to come forward.
Sure. And while they're coming up, Senator Gerlach, I believe, has the same bill because it has the same.
I think there are three others. Larson. Senator Larson has one.
He's an education committee. But Senator Wergen, before we have testimony, do you have anything to add? Or Senator Larson, I think, has the same bill. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just that Senator Rest is right. This is good tax policy. It's a good way to do it. It's kind of a, I don't know, I always call it kind of a Mickey Mouse system when you make people have to pay it up front and then file for a rebate, hoping that they don't all file for a rebate so the state keeps some of the money, because that's kind of what we all know happens. And I would like to see us get to a better policy. Yes, the price tag is expensive, and we realize that has to be taken into consideration, but let's look at it as a good policy and see if we can move forward.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, could I ask Senator Rest and Senator Wergen if she has a view on this? This is a pretty expensive investment, and it is an economic tool as well. The governor has proposed sales tax exemption on transportation costs, highway costs, transit costs. Other senators have proposed sales tax exemptions for state and local governments so that they don't pay state sales tax. How do you see all these fitting together, if you do? And maybe you're not prepared to answer that question now, but how would you prioritize our expenditures towards sales tax exemptions? Assuming that you had $100 million, how would you? Would you start with this because of the economic development impact and the investment in businesses, or one of those other types of sales tax exemptions?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, a couple of things come to mind. One is I do think that this would be my highest priority. I'm not sure that if it's $100 million, you could do this, period. But it seems to me that one of the things that is scalable that we should start dealing with is the sales tax that we impose on local government purchases. And I think we need to move away from that policy as well as a general policy. I am less enamored of the special requests that come in over and over again that ask for being excused from paying sales tax on projects where the builder is not the owner. And we often have that, and that's specifically excluded in the definition of capital equipment, by the way, but we give all kinds of exemptions on project by project for construction, and it seems to me that if that happens, that happening over and over again suggests that the tax committee, in my mind at least, should be looking at what should be a general tax policy with regard to tax exemptions for construction materials. And it would be interesting to see what the revenue estimate would be if you just came up with a specific definition of what constituted construction materials and then had a bill that exempted them, regardless of whether the builder was the owner or not, and see what that costs. And if with the magnitude of that cost, scaling it back to a policy that would be palatable to the committee, and where when someone was coming to ask for a special exemption, that you maybe could cut down on some of those requests and bills because you had an overall general policy in place. But I think that the upfront exemption, as opposed to the refund, is a clearest example of good tax policy that would be my first priority. But then secondly, I'd go straight to the taxes that we impose on local government purchases.
Senator Gerlach, we're giving authors of the upfront capital or the upfront sales tax exemption on capital equipment an opportunity to tell the committee why they have a good idea. Senator Rest has done that. Senator Wergen has done that. Senator Larson's going to get his chance, but right now it's your turn to tell us why this is a good idea. In these difficult budget times when we have competing priorities.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, I exactly for that reason, there's competing priorities. There's a lot of things going on. When
when we have times where budgets are tight, we do things. We ask for advance payments. We do different shifts. We do different things. And I'm no expert in tax policy, but this was brought to me, and I know that others have brought it forth. I just think it makes sense that we should try and do something along these lines to try to fix some of these pieces that we have in our tax policy. Otherwise, I think over time, the whole thing is just going to start to fall apart. So now I think it's the time to try to fix some of these, patch some of these things, and get back on the right track. And this is one of those things I think makes sense.
Senator Larson, anything as an author you want the committee to consider?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Senator Rest and Senator Wergen and Senator Gerlach have given a lot of good arguments. I guess the one that compels me to be involved in the issue is that when I think of any tax, I'm hoping that the tax is a fair tax across all those that are intended to be taxed. And I think with the refund, we have circumstances where some of the larger companies have the ability to track and file their refunds, and smaller companies perhaps get hit harder, and that's in that they don't it's a cost of business that they are unable or unwilling or unknowing that they can afford. So but Senator Rest has also laid out the financial cost here, and which is daunting, but I think it's the right thing to do. So but we do have a lot of priorities too.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support this. I really appreciate all the work you've done on this and your new ideas, too. I like the phase-in idea a lot. But what's important to remind ourselves about this versus the other exemptions is once this is bought out, it's neutral. You know, we're just buying out the swap, basically, and that's what makes this probably the first priority.
Senator Wergen?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Rest alluded to it too, but this is part of a greater sales tax policy issue. This would be my first choice because of the economic development impact, especially in greater Minnesota. I think it has quite an impact. But beyond that, just the fact that we are having businesses apply for exemptions and we have local units of government collecting sales tax, and that ends up on property tax, which is kind of a corny way to do business. And sales tax is a political hot-button issue, and I'm not saying that in a partisan manner. That's a hot-button issue for both sides of the aisle. But at some point, we have to have the good policy decision. In other words, what's right to charge sales tax on and what's wrong to charge sales tax on? What's the logic behind the current method that we have for sales tax in exempting services? What's wrong? Is there something wrong with that? Is there something wrong with not putting sales tax on clothing? We need to have the time and the courage to have an entire sales tax policy decision and then decide what's best for the state instead of the piecemeal system that we have. And I remember formerly being in business, there were times when I wasn't even sure what I was supposed to be charging sales tax on. It was that unclear. So sometimes you charged it just in case you were supposed to, and you paid that into the state. But it was not always that clear. And so I think there has to be that full discussion by hopefully this committee with you as a chair. I'd like to see that.
Senator Wergen, if the chair was to try to put together a bill similar to what former Governor Ventura proposed that expanded the sales tax and maybe lowered the number, would you be willing to sign on it with the chair as an author?
I would absolutely be willing to look at it and consider that as a part of sales tax reform, because I think we have a very messy system the way it is. So it would be something I told my folks when I was running for election both the first time and the second time, I will take on the controversial issues, and you might not always like what you hear out of my mouth, but I'm going to be honest, and if we need to confront something in a bipartisan manner, I'll sit at the table and confront it to get to the root of the problem.
Senator, we're going to have a good discussion here. We need a vehicle. Was that a yes?
Senator Bach?
Senator Rest.
You can have a yes from me.
Senator Wergen?
Mr. Chair, show me the bill.
Senator Orban, what do you think?
Well, Mr. Chair,
be an author and have the discussion?
I've done that on other bills that you've asked me to sign as well, just for purposes of discussion, and I would do it as well on that. My thinking about this is in line with Senator Rest's, that we should do something for the bigger picture here, because we keep getting these bills like the Thompson West
comes forward and says, well, we need a sales tax exemption. And if the state of Minnesota continues to grant those requests at the expense of the capital equipment folks that are willing to invest, we're hurting all those businesses statewide in favor and in favoritism for one or two that have a big voice and have a big bully pulpit and get the governor's attention. And frankly, I don't think that's a very wise policy. I think we should be looking at the overall investment that Minnesotans and Minnesota businesses make regularly. They're already doing it. They're not asking for special permission. They're just asking us to put the paperwork in order and make it a real exemption at the time of the investment. And I think we should do it. And I think it should be our highest priority. If we have dollars that we can devote to sales tax policy and tax exemptions, this should be the first 100. And I even have to say that over and above the local state or the local county and city sales tax, even though it means that the Carver County Courthouse is still going to have to be financed and we're still going to have to pay sales tax on the construction, pet peeve of mine, I think we need to do this and it should be our first priority. And Senator Rest, Senator Gerlach, Senator Wergen, I think I've signed all of your bills. I support your effort and sign me up. Let me help in any way I can. But that's what I think, Mr. Chair. Let's just do it and do it for all those right reasons.
Senator Gerlach, what do you think? A vehicle in front of this committee that expands the sales tax and likely lowers the rate. Would you be willing to sign on it with me?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I'm open to revenue-neutral proposals. So if we can eliminate the income tax for consumption tax, I'm open to the discussion, but I don't think I'd sign on a bill that wasn't revenue-neutral.
Is this bill revenue-neutral, Senator Gerlach?
It is not.
Senator Rest, maybe we should get to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, as they're coming up, you're going to start. I want to go back to a comment that Senator Johnson made that I do think is an important difference between changing from refund to an exemption as opposed to taking away the sales tax on local government purchases. And this, the cost that's here is not that the businesses don't get the money back that they paid in. It's simply a timing issue, which is why the cost of it diminishes over the years rather than increases in terms of the impact on revenues to the state. So I think that was a very important addition to the discussion. I appreciate it. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dave Dietrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And in the interest of getting other testifiers up here, I'll be very brief. So I'll just give you a brief synopsis of our position, and then I'll turn the platform over to our members. And we have several here. They're not all going to testify, but if you could stand up just so that the members of the committee could see who you are, if you're interested in talking to some of them further, I'm sure they'd be happy to discuss this issue with you. Also, some of them do have some of their rebates or their refund applications with them, if they could hold those up so you can see kind of what an arduous process this can be, particularly for small businesses. That's for 1 year. So I'll just simply state that the Chamber supports this bill. We'd like to see the capital equipment refund program move to an upfront exemption. We believe this will simplify the administration of the tax, and it will actually simplify the compliance costs for businesses and help reduce administrative burden on the state. The program would help small employers in particular because they no longer have to finance the tax themselves in order to improve their cash flow situations. It also provides tax relief for a lot of small businesses that either don't know about the program or can't afford the time to fill out those long applications. We believe this legislation has the dual benefit of helping business as well as reducing administrative burdens on the state. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, but I would also like to get some of our members up here to share their stories with you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm offended you didn't ask if I'd sign on.
Senator Johnson, would you?
I certainly would.
Good. Well, I mean, in all seriousness, Senator Gerlach, in all seriousness, if we're going to have the discussion about expanding the sales tax and hopefully lowering the rate, we need a bill in front of us. And it would be, I appreciate Senator Ortman and Senator Johnson's and maybe yours, Senator Wergen's.
If it's revenue neutral, I'm there.
It would lower the rate, I would think, and how we put that all in balance, I don't know. But if we're ever going to do the right thing and actually do what something along the lines of what Governor Ventura proposed, I think we need to go down that road together. and I appreciate willingness on some members of the committee to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
I think one of the problems with that, if you lower the rate, the number of cities coming in for a piggyback sales tax request is going to go right through the roof. You know, whenever they can say, well, we will raise this tax, but you won't pay anymore, boy, that gets to be pretty, that's just, same thing happens at different times we've lowered the property tax. Well, if you vote for the swimming pool thing here, we aren't going to have an increase in your taxes. And I think the same thing could happen there. And I'm not saying it isn't good policy. I kind of think it is, but prepare for the onslaught.
Mr. Diedrichs, you've got some members of your association who would like to testify. Let's get to some real people from that are actually understand how cumbersome this process is.
I have a hand up for the committee.
Just someone will come here. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman,
welcome
and
to
members.
The Tax Committee.
Thank you. My name is Dick Young. I own a small business in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. I'm also the chairman of the Minnesota Manufacturers Coalition. I'm here today on behalf of the coalition members that could not attend, and we'll keep this short. The coalition was organized 3 years ago and is comprised of associations with memberships of manufacturers from many industries. Some of these are the chemical industry, foundries, mold makers, welders, fabricators, machinists, metal casters, printers, metal formers, and the plastic industry, just to name a few. The associations these companies are members of, in many cases, are statewide, from northeast Minnesota, northwest Minnesota, west central Minnesota, the metro area, pretty much covers the whole state. The overwhelming majority of our members are small to mid-sized companies, are probably under 200 employees. The main objective of the coalition has been to support the full repeal of the collection of sales tax on capital equipment for manufacturers. Capital equipment is exempt from tax today, but manufacturers being required to pay in have to apply for the refund. This results in financial burdens that cause many small to mid-sized companies cash flow problems, financing problems, budgeting problems, and seriously hinder expansion and growth. These burdens also have an effect on our ability to compete with our neighboring states who don't have this issue. As the costs relating to operation of any business rise and margins narrow, this repeal is even more important to the well-being of Minnesota's manufacturing community. It's estimated that 1 in 7 workers in Minnesota is employed by a manufacturer. This is more than 342,000 people. Financial pressure on a business eventually filters down to the workers in one way or another, with lost benefits being the obvious and raises being the obvious examples. As a coalition, we oppose industry favorites. Our bill is to benefit all the industries. We do not believe that it is good policy to discriminate against one and for another. So we see that our bills that you've talked about this morning here really are good for all the small to mid-sized businesses. I know there are individual stories that will be shared today, but I want to encourage you to consider the full repeal of this collection for all manufacturers this year. As the cost of equipment continues to rise, the cost of this change will rise as well. Now's the time to get this done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Young.
Mr. Chairman and Committee, I'm Maureen Steinwall. I own Steinwall Incorporated up in Coon Rapids. It's a thermoplastic injection molding company. And in addition to that, I have a CPA, MBA, PhD, so I kind of get it from a tax law perspective also, but I'll be the first to admit that, you know, there might be some uniquenesses about this I'm not thoroughly familiar with. But this is my 1 year tax return that I have to fill out, and because I'm a CPA, I can do it. But it takes about a week and a half of my time of just gathering the documentation, my staff's time. So it's incredibly cumbersome from that perspective, totally non-value added. I have been testifying on this issue. This is a 20-year-old issue. I've been testifying for 10. It's absolutely delightful to hear that the conversation is now finally in our favor, it sounds. But I came prepared to reframe this, because it seems like the logical verses aren't making the impact that it needed to be. Let me reframe this and give you some words that share with you the anger that's starting to boil up in the small business community. This is not your revenue. This is therefore not the cost to the state of Minnesota. This is strictly some money that's coming into the state, maybe by distortion. I mean, no disrespect. I'm just trying to use bigger words here. You're distorting money from the small, from the community of business to then cash flow the state's revenue, and now you package it as a cost to the state. It wasn't revenue to begin with. So because of the terminology, when cash flow was tight, you asked us to kind of pull back a bit and say, you know, it's all right to wait on cash flow, but now the cash flow is strong for the state, we support you completely in saying, let's fix this so that you're not taking money from the business community that wasn't yours to take to begin with. Now, I apologize if those words maybe sounded tough, but that's how it feels sometimes, is that this is not a tax that the state of Minnesota should have collected. I mean, you just no disrespect. But, you know, this is what we do through every year, and I'm delighted to hear that you're talking in our favor. Thank you.
Ms. Steinwald, I think you have an accurate description.
Thank you. It's a little gutsy to come up and have to say it in strong words, but we need to do something, would be my thoughts. You're an ethical body. This is an ethical issue, I think.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I appreciate your testimony very much. Some of the businesses don't have the ability to have someone in-house that can do the CPA work to present the refund request. And so the way I look at this, there is a cost to the business just for the preparation. It may even be having to go outside to find someone to document it. But is there also the cost of carrying? Because are they paying interest from your experience? Are these businesses paying interest on this money because they're carrying essentially a loan for the state of Minnesota?
Well, to answer the question specifically, I'd like to back up. Every time it appears as if I file for a refund, I have had 4 sales tax audits. And it's timed approximately at the time when I get my refund back. There's no linkage there. I can't prove it. I've paid $15 of legitimate sales taxes here, but I've gone through 4 sales tax audits. Now, someone who's not educated in my field is not going to take the bully on. And so there's a perception that, I might have a $3,000 refund, but I'm not going to kick the state of Minnesota auditors to come in here, because who knows? So you tend to take a little bit of a backward seat. I know of others that don't even file or don't even pay the tax. Now, you can do it because many of the transactions are use tax. It's not that the suppliers are collecting the tax to begin with. On our honor, we pay the tax first as a use tax, and then we turn around and apply for a refund. Well, there's many of us that are not even doing that anymore because we don't want to kind of pay it in just to have to refund it back, because when we refund it back, we get an audit. Now, it's the cost is, I don't like feeling like a criminal, if you will. If you have to not pay your use tax, then I'm not following the law, and that's not who I am. But sometimes funding, you know, I had $67,000 into the state. That's my yearly profit that was withheld. It took 18 months to get back once. I paid it in because I'm a legitimate taxpayer, and I'm doing it the way you've asked me to do it. It's not that we're asking for an exemption. We already have the exemption. We're merely asking for us not to have to play a bookkeeping. It's a record-keeping game. I give it to you, you give it back. I'm not your banker, basically.
Senator Sanjan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps my question is to our analyst, but looking at the fiscal note here and looking at 08-09 and aggregating those about $120 million. Is that $120 million at least projectedly money that would come in but somehow wouldn't be asked for in a rebate, or is it lost interest income, or is it something else? Is that really money that we're going to be losing? That's my question. Ms. Von Mosch?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's my understanding, reading the revenue estimate, that these figures are a combination of refunds of paperwork that's in the pipeline and future exemptions that would be an increase in exemptions that are being claimed now because of the paperwork, that there are a certain number of businesses that don't claim the refund right now. I do have a call into the revenue department because another member asked a question about splitting out the $77 million so that we can see how much of that is actually increased activity versus money that's already in the pipeline ready to be refunded. That person who I need to talk to isn't at his desk right now, but I'll be able to get that information for you in the next day or so.
Is he in the room?
No, I don't believe he's in the room. He's one of the researchers, but maybe Jack can help
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Resk?
I don't think that, just like when a tax is imposed, we expect 100% compliance. It's not an option whether you report the use tax. The law requires you to. And I would think that the refund also, even if it's not the case in actual, we don't do dynamic scoring here in our budgeting, and we do static scoring, and so they have to assume 100% compliance. That 100% of the people who are eligible for this would take it, even if we know in reality that that they don't, and they can't make an estimate based on guessing how many people are not going to take it, or on the other hand, how many people are not going to pay it. I mean, there are scofflaws who don't pay the use tax, but we only have, I think for individuals, we have a de minimis amount of $150 that we let them get, we let them be excused from. But as far as I know, the Department of Revenue always does 100% compliance or participation, even if that doesn't happen in, quote, real life.
Mr. Manson, anything to add to Senator Sundrum's question from the department?
No, Mr. Chair. Jack Manson with the Department of Revenue. And, just to kind of maybe help explain this, what you're seeing in the fiscal note, the revenue analysis, is just a shift. Where these refunds would be paid out over time, now with an upfront exemption, there's a shift. So that's really what you're looking at here. And there's kind of an overlap of refunds that are in the works or in the process and then going to an upfront. So it's kind of, they're piled on top of each other, but it's just mainly a shift because they would pay this tax and then apply for a refund and get it over time anyway. So it's just, what you're seeing is an overlapping shift from a fiscal year to a future fiscal year.
Mr. Manson, the department's fiscal note says that, I'll read exactly what it says. There are approximately 10,000 potential beneficiaries. About 2,000 capital equipment refund claims were received in fiscal year 06. Are there people eligible for this that aren't claiming the refund?
Mr. Chairman, I think in the numbers here, there's built in, I believe it's around $4 or $5 million a year increased participation. And we heard from the testimony that there are some smaller businesses that don't have the staff that are entitled to this refund and don't apply for it. So I think there is, going forward, some increased participation. I thought it was like $4 or $5 million a year. That's just another, argument in favor of this, that people that are really entitled to this should be getting it, and they just don't have the capability to apply for it.
Senator Moi?
Mr. Chair, my question has been answered.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Sundrum.
I'm not sure if I'm understanding here, but my bottom line question is, if we do this, and I think it's a good idea, but if we do this, what are the budget implications? Is it truly $120 million? I would guess we'd probably lose a little interest income. I mean, I would suspect we get this money, it goes into some kind of a short-term investment or, into the pool. It does accrue some interest. I don't know how much. But
Mr. Manson, how much does it cost?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, This revenue analysis doesn't include any impact with lost revenue, or lost interest, I'm sorry. It just takes into okay. consideration the revenues that would be going out the door in a quicker fashion. So it's just a shift. There's no okay. consideration of the lost in investment interest in this calculation at all. This is just a shift. And the 120 is what would be scored as the revenue impact in the 08-09 biennium.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Pogelman.
Chair, Mr. Manson, could you clarify what the governor's rec is? Governor's recommendation?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pogelman, the governor had two pieces in his bill. One was a upfront exemption for the wood products industry, and the other piece is an exemption for small businesses, that they would get an upfront exemption, and that would be for businesses that have 20 or fewer employees and less than $1 million in annual revenues. So he was trying to take an incremental approach to mm-hmm. try and move this along the best he could.
And Mr. Manson, refresh my memory what the fiscal note on that was. 11 million or so?
Mr. Chairman, I have that back at the desk. Not sure.
Ms. Von Mosch?
Mr. Chair, members, for the small business exemption, it was $8.5 million in 08-09, and for the forest products, it was 2.5 if you round up, in 08-09.
So $11 million for the biennium?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pogelman.
Then, Mr. Manson, why did the governor not do the entire amount that the four or five bills, the Rest bill and the Wergen bill and the Gerlach bill, why didn't the governor's recommendation do that if it was good public policy? And then why pick the two that the governor picked? Because, as you know, I have a bill that picks somebody else.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogelman, the decision came down on whether to do a full upfront capital equipment exemption versus other priorities. The governor just went with other priorities in his budget.
It's mine.
As far as why the wood products industry, there was a task force that the governor put together to help that industry, and one of the, I think the only tax provision that they were really pushing was for upfront capital equipment exemption.
Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a clarifying question from Mr. Manson. So is the $4 or $5 million number that you talked about in the $121 million fiscal note?
Mr. Chair and Senator Larson, actually the $4 or $5 million would be throughout all the years, but it's probably more implications in the 2010-2011 numbers. But so if you look at that $10,400,000, I think the number is like $4 or $5 million of that is kind of increased participation. So when you look at 08-09, that's really the basic shift from a refund process to an upfront exemption.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Rest, other testifiers? Do we have more? Mm-hmm. We need to kind of move along here.
Mr. Can I speak,
go
sir?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Dave Owen. I represent DHY Corporation from Lakeville, Minnesota. We're a small business engaged in the precision machining and manufacture of items for commercial, medical, and defense applications. We've been in business for about 26 or 28 years. And over that period of time, we have transacted about something like $120 million of gross sales, the vast majority of which has come in from out of state. So these are out of state revenues. I that come into our state. You might be pleased to know that some of them even came from South Dakota and Wisconsin, but most of them came from coastal regions. I don't believe that I'm alone here today in my experience, and that is that some of you may regard the urging by business owners to go with a point-of-sale exemption on sales tax rather than the refund policy as a mere money grab or something that's just going to enhance their already fat bottom line. In fact, that is not the case. People in our business are fighting to survive. In the early 90s, we had 225 employees. Today, we have 65. And that is the result of direct competition with foreign companies located in China and India and other Pacific Rim nations, where we're competing in a very vigorous way in a very price-competitive market. So every little bit helps. And echoing the earlier testimony, when this money is taken out of circulation within our businesses, it hurts very badly. And there are times when a company like mine, which is about a $10 million company, is flying pretty close to the treetops, so to speak, in terms of the amount of cash reserve or cash flow that we have to stay viable and stay in the game. So refunds or taxes that are levied and such things that are on the order of 6-7% like sales tax are on multi-million dollar capital purchases, they make a huge difference. You've got $70,000 or $100,000+ at times that is in limbo. And echoing the earlier testimony, the same experience. We have expected a refund only to receive instead an audit notice and then go through the audit and find out everything's fine and ultimately get the money back anyway. So if I could use a word picture, from our perspective, it feels a little bit like the state's going into a hospital and taking blood away from sick patients who really need that blood, and it's just sticking it on a shelf somewhere, and then ultimately giving it back to the patient after sufficiently beating him up to determine that he really deserves to get it back. And it just doesn't seem to make sense, given the paperwork burden, the time and cost of doing it all. I also have a question that speaks to the revenue neutrality or not for the state. It seems to us that, at least in my experience, the state has expended considerable energy and effort just verifying our story. And I don't know if the costs of all of that, in terms of personnel, time, equipment, transportation, et cetera, even just storage for the mountain of documents that get submitted, is that being figured into the cost to the state? Because, of course, it is a real cost. And if you're just ending up giving the funds back, then it's possibly revenue negative in that sense for the state. So I just add my voice among many. There are many of us who are all in with personal guarantees on debt, and it really hurts to go out and borrow money to pay your sales tax on something. So I urge the point-of-sale exemption and repeal. It's just it's a policy that doesn't make sense, and it penalizes the means of production.
Thank you, Mr. Owen. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the testifier just commented on the point I wanted to reiterate, is a lot of times these businesses are carrying lines of credit against these refunds, and the interest on that is huge to these businesses. The other thing I'd also like to mention is last year we had testimony from the department that they would actually like to do away with this too. So, unlike maybe what you're feeling as far as these audits, they don't like the extra work involved either.
But my name is David Lenz, and I'm with Liberty Diversified Industries. We are a larger company. We have about 1,000 employees in the state of Minnesota. We have manufacturing in Golden Valley and Brooklyn Park. Excuse me. Recycling paper mill in Becker, Minnesota. We manufacture corrugated plastic in New Hope, and we're in metal manufacturing in Lake City, Minnesota. I don't know that I can add a lot to what has been said. I didn't think in advance for two reasons. I didn't think in advance or didn't bring the refund. One, I didn't remember it or didn't think of doing it in advance. And two, I'm too old and too weak to carry that much paper all at one time. It is just huge, the amount of time and paper that we spend in applying for that refund. Estimate is that we spend over 500 hours a year in applying for the refund. Now, is that a lot of time for a company our size? Actually, yes, it is. We are fighting every day to reduce costs. That's an absolute non-value-added cost. The customer gets no value from it. Our product gets no value from it. In addition, the waste of time that the state spends in processing those refunds should be taken into account. So it's infuriating to me to watch the whole process take place. I appreciated the earlier comment, the Mickey Mouse comment that was used. That is what we look at it as. I appreciate the comments on the integrity of the state. I believe it is an integrity of the state tax system in making this change. So I urge you to match the action or match the discussion we keep having of trying to make Minnesota a place for manufacturers. Match that discussion with action and change the law. Thank you.
Senator Rest, anybody else to testify? Is Mr. Hesse in the room?
If we could, I have a question for Mr. Hesse. Mr. Hesse, is this a priority of the state chamber?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, it is. We would like to, as it has been for several years, we'd like to see this completed for all the reasons that the members stated.
Mr. Hesse, I developed a problem in the last week. I really wanted to do this, and looking at the November forecast, I thought, you know, there's a way that we can fit this into our tax bill. But as a result of the February forecast, where in fiscal years 10 and 11, we actually lost $418 million in the tails, I feel a bit of an urgency to put some additional money into the budget reserve. There is a great deal of concern by a number of us about what the next biennium brings. Our state economist was here and talked about some real potential instability in the state's revenue stream. So I Senator Cohen and I are discussing, along with Senator Pogomiller, how much one-time money the tax committee is going to get. And we all around this table have to make a decision if we're going to spend that one-time money on trying to do this, which I very much would like to try and do, $120 million in this biennium, or if we're going to put that money into the budget reserve. And Mr. Hesse, I'd just like to know what the chamber thinks. If looking at the most recent forecast and losing the money in the tails that we lost, I think keeping a budget in balance in 10 and 11, structural balance, is very, very important. So I'm interested in the observation of the chamber. If we have to, in our competing priorities, weigh doing this against putting the $120 million into the budget reserve, what does the chamber think I should do?
Mr. Chair, both budget reserve and an upfront exemption are I think, important issues for you to tackle. If a upfront exemption cannot be accomplished immediately, I think we take Senator Rest up on her offer to find a way to try to phase it in somehow or you know, work so that we can at least get it on the books so that all companies can expect to have an upfront exemption at some point in time later. That may help you out with your tail issue. But it, again, we think it's important policy to adopt in the state, and would be happy to work with you and Senator Rest and the other authors of the bills to find a way to make that happen over time.
Mr. Hesse, is it more important to do this than to have structural balance in fiscal years 10 and 11?
Mr. Chair, I think it's certainly important to maintain structural balance in 10 and 11.
Anybody else on the committee have anything to add? Mr. Hesse, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Senator Rest, anything to add?
No, sir. I'm done.
Thank you. Chair lays over Senate File 117 for possible inclusion without objection. Senator Pogomiller.
Chairman, this is just a continuation of the same discussion. Just to offer the committee another option, maybe along the line, something you could piece together with the governor's approach of picking one or two industries that could make a difference. The suggestion here is to use about $6 million one time to accomplish this for the printing industry. And I just wanted to, it's a strategic industry for the state. We're national leaders in this industry. It's about 800 businesses. And I want Mr. Jesse Mark Jesse to comment on why this approach for this particular industry might make a difference at this point in time, understanding all the other comments that have already been made about the overall policy.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm another real person. My name is Mark Jessen, and I appreciate this opportunity to testify today in support of Senate file number 882 on behalf of the printing industry of Minnesota, the trade association that represents Minnesota's printing and publishing industry. According to the Department of Employment and Economic Development, the printing and publishing industry is the largest manufacturing industry in Minnesota. In 2005, Deed reports that Minnesota's printing industry had 75,000 employees, over 3% of all Minnesota workers. For every 100 direct jobs in the printing industry, an additional 133 jobs are created in Minnesota's economy. Minnesota's leading printing and publishing centers are located throughout the state, with about two-thirds of the jobs located in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. I own Jessen Press, a small printing company with 24 employees located in St. Louis Park. I didn't bring a poster today. You could say we're probably on the opposite end of the business spectrum from Thompson West. The company started in Minneapolis in 1952 as C&J Publishing. My father began working as shop manager for the company in 1959 and bought the company in 1967. In 1969, he moved the company to St. Louis Park. I graduated from the University of Minnesota in 1985. Because the ink was in my veins, I went to work for the family business on the following Monday. I bought the company from my father in 1995 when he retired. Although we're a small family-owned business, we have to invest in the most expensive technology in the industry to stay competitive. Our state-of-the-art equipment includes extensive pre-press computer graphics and layout equipment. I own four Heidelberg presses as well as complete bindery and mailing manufacturing machines. We have to continually upgrade our equipment to compete at what has become a global printing industry. You'd be amazed at the number of Minnesota companies that are having their printing done in China or elsewhere around the world. To compete in this global market, Minnesota's printing companies have to work harder and smarter and faster. Those of you who were on this committee last year may remember the printing industry's testimony in support of Senator Tomasani's bill to repeal the capital equipment tax. Minnesota's printers support the complete repeal of the capital equipment tax. I think you are well aware of the problems with this tax and the burden on small companies such as mine to pay the tax and have to fill out the forms and wait months to get that tax refunded, as we've heard from earlier testimony. The cost of tracking receipts, filing refund forms, and complying with the administrative costs of this program are extensive. The capital equipment tax needs to be repealed. Having said that, we recognize that not everyone will get what they want this session. While the Department of Revenue testified at the hearing last session that they believed the time had come to repeal the capital equipment tax, the administration's bill provides relief only for small employers, defined as less than 20 employees, and annual gross revenues of less than $1 million. This would not benefit me or my company because I have 24 employees. The governor's bill also calls for repeal of the tax on the wood products industry, loggers, and paper manufacturers. The printing industry understands the need to provide relief to the wood products industry, and we support this provision. Minnesota's logging and paper industries are vital partners with Minnesota's printing industry. You might think of Minnesota's loggers, paper companies, and printing industry as the three legs of a stool. When one of us is hurting, it directly affects the others. When one of us is growing and getting stronger, it helps the others to grow and get stronger as well. As I mentioned earlier, for every 100 jobs in the printing industry, an additional 133 are created. When printing companies in the Twin Cities and around Minnesota grow, we need more of the paper that is produced in northern Minnesota, and those paper companies in turn need more wood from Minnesota loggers. Of course, when I have thousands of dollars sitting at the Department of Revenue and I'm waiting for my capital equipment tax refund, I can't invest those dollars in new equipment and hiring additional employees. And if I'm not expanding my operations, that directly affects Minnesota's loggers and paper companies and the larger Minnesota economy. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, Minnesota's printing industry greatly appreciates Senator Pogomiller introducing this bill, and you're co-signing the bill along with Senators Ortman, Dibble, and Moi. We support the targeted industry-specific tax relief for the logging and paper industries contained in the governor's tax bill and ask that you consider including Minnesota's printing industry with these two sister industries when you develop your omnibus tax bill if you are not able to repeal the tax completely on all industries. Thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to attempt to answer any questions which you may have.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogomar.
Mr. Chairman, it does seem like, depending on the amount of revenue that the committee has available, that some combination of the governor's proposal and this proposal could help us in a strategic area of industry right now. So just an option available to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Pogomiller. Chair lays over without objection Senate File 882 for possible inclusion. Members, we've got two other short ones left. Senate File 1378. Is Mr. Manson here? Members, under Mr. Moen here?
Yes, he is.
Members, Senate File 1378, under current law, when we receive contraband cigarettes, the state has three options. We can either use them to give to patients in state institutions, we can sell them at public auction, or we can destroy them. And I think considering we probably don't want to put them back into circulation, I don't know how old this language is, and we probably don't want to provide them to patients in state institutions. What this bill does is say that the only option that the state has in the future is to destroy them. That's really all that the bill does. Mr. Manson, would you like to speak to it?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Jack Manson with the Department of Revenue. And no, we're in support of this bill. We currently don't give the cigarettes away, which is one of the options, and there also is, we can put it up for auction. And I think we did that once 7 or 8 years ago, and I don't think anybody showed up. And part of the problem is that there's an appeal period, and when in time that all works through, the cigarettes and the other tobacco products are getting old, and we're fine with using them in kind of sting operations or sort of compliance activities.
Council, we have an A1 amendment. Can you explain what we're doing with the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment basically makes a little bit of change to the original language of the bill about what the commission can do with the forfeited property. Originally, the bill allowed for property to be used in ongoing civil investigations. The amendment would make that so that it can only be used in criminal investigations, as Mr. Manson mentioned, sting operations, sort of things. It also adds the requirement that after it's used for those purposes, it is then destroyed after that. And those are really the only changes that the amendment.
Mr. Manson, department support the A1 amendment?
We'd be fine with the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson moves the A1 amendment. Any questions? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion fails. A1 amendment is adopted. Any other questions, members? Anybody in the audience want to testify for or against the bill? Without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 1378 as amended for possible inclusion. One other small one, members, that I see has a bigger fiscal note than I thought. Mr. Moe? Senate File 709. As I understand it, members, under current law, where we have different kinds of shooting organizations, when an individual goes there to purchase a round of, say, shooting clays, they pay sales tax on that activity. The organization that hosts it also, in addition, pays sales tax on the inputs, on the actual sporting clays. So I think you can make an argument that people are being taxed twice on the sporting clays. Once when the owner of the facility buys the sporting clays, and then a second time when the individual who comes to participate in the activity then pays sales tax on the overall activity, so the sales tax is being paid twice. So, Mr. Moe, did I characterize this accurately?
Yes. My name is Dean Moe. I represent the Minnesota Horse and Hunt Club based in Prior Lake, probably one of the largest shooting facilities in the state. And we currently pay that sales tax on the wholesale level. We're just briefly speaking on behalf of the industry, some of the gun clubs around the state do not pay the wholesale tax. They just charge the sales tax and pay that to the state. And so there has been some complications with the Department of Revenue, and this would just kind of clarify at what level do we pay that tax. So just briefly.
Mr. Manson, is there any confusion in the department on how the sales tax is applied to this activity? Did I characterize it accurately?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I don't believe there's any confusion in the department. I think your interpretation was right. The inputs that would be taxable along with the admission charges as well, there's just not an exemption in the statute that would provide for an exemption on these inputs, so a law change would be needed.
Members, I was hoping we could do this, and I was surprised to see the fiscal note is $200,000 a year, but it's, Mr. Moe, it's made more difficult when I see the fiscal note on it, but we will, as we kind of put our bill together, we'll kind of, it'll have to compete with other priorities, I guess. But Senator Larson?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if you could tell me what a round of shooting clay costs.
Mr. Moe, can you tell us what a round of shooting clays costs?
Currently, if you're trap and skeet at the Horse and Hunt Club, is $9 for 25 targets. In the sporting clays, which is like golf with a shotgun, it's $22 for 50 targets. So you're collecting 6.5% on the $22 round.
Any other questions, members? Chair lays over Senate File 709 as amended for possible inclusion. Members, thank you. We've got a pretty long agenda again on Thursday. The first thing we're going to take up is Senator Jungbauer. So that'll be an addition to our agenda that was already sent out. So this meeting's adjourned.